The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Richard Lee.
For 3 days in April, the books industry relocates to Earl's Court.
Good morning, London Book Fair.
Publishers and agents playing an international game of musical chairs as they snap up manuscripts and parcel out rights. This year, Korea is the guest of honour, bringing a host of authors from smartphone superstars to chroniclers of a divided nation, as Claire Armitstead discovered last month. What about closer to home?
Aris Thomas said that translating was like kissing somebody through a handkerchief. And of course, when I opened the book, this was written much longer than that. But what's interesting about Aris Thomas is,
according to Stefan Tobler, publisher, translation specialist, and other stories, some of the most exciting voices in world literature are to be found right on our doorstep.
To name a few, I mean, Laszlo Krasznahorkai from Hungary. He won't be everyone's cup of tea. Very long sentences, but brilliant sort of larger-than-life characters in village settings. Think of a book like Satan Tango. You just need to sort of just sink into this with these wonderful, different experiences. Another one would be Peter Hanke from Austria. I'd really recommend a book which has just come out in English, translated by Martin Chalmers for Seagull Books, set in a small village on the Slovenian-Austrian border. It's about an orchard, it's about country living, it's about the war, it's about a multilingual area. Beautiful. A third one is an author, actually, that I've heard about very recently now, just before the fair, a French writer called Emmanuelle Pagano, and she writes just beautiful books.
Now, is there such a thing, do you think, as a European novel, a European attitude to fiction? Is there a sensibility?
In German literature, there was a big movement in the 90s to probably become more Anglo-Saxon. There was a lot of writing that came on where I think a lot of people were feeling a lot of the writing wasn't particularly easily readable, and they wanted something more Anglo-Saxon with a great plot and short sentences. But at the same time, there is a real tradition of experimentation in Europe, which is still alive, and that's certainly what I am interested in, people who are playful with language and playful with form. I mean, Emmanuelle Pagano, she has this book which is a series of vignettes of different short bits from different marriages, relationships, taken through a small physical object or tick or something that really throws a light on it. And I think those sort of unusual perspectives are something that in Europe authors are very good at doing. High culture is definitely something which is not sort of scoffed at or seen as some sort of right-wing ploy to keep the working class down. In many places it's seen as simply a chance of looking for beauty.
And with the Booker Prize now opening its doors up to writing in English from all over the world, do you think there's a danger that people will feel that's kind of the world done and we don't have to worry about writing in other languages?
It is a shame they didn't take that opportunity and just widen it to any book published in the UK, whether it had been originally written in another language or not, because at the end of the day, for such an important prize, you want to feel that the best writers published that year are all up for the award. And of course for us and other stories, we publish more translations than anything else. And it's always a shame that then those other writers of a similar quality to Deborah Levy will never get that attention that the Booker Prize can give.
For example, a Japanese author that maybe was translated into French, is it likely that it would go from French to English, or would it always go from Japanese?
For Maike Tiervogel, publisher of the translation specialist Pirini Press, the European literary sensibility offers a different perspective on modern life.
So, for example, in Spain, a recurring image over and over again seems to be hospital. A lot of protagonists in Spanish books are at the moment in hospital or in a sanatoriums. Sadly, not much else is then happening. Albanian stories, Turkish stories, a lot of prisons, a lot of stories about army and young men going into the army, being unhappy in the army, so confined spaces, and a lot of stories about rape. Germany seeking fathers and lost fathers. So the Germans are still trying to come to terms with their father figures, which of course for me as a German is very interesting.
Parini started off specialising in shorter fiction, in translation, the novella even. Does that flourish particularly on the continent?
It certainly has, more so than here. However, there is definitely also what I'm very aware of in the UK, there is definitely a trend back towards shorter fiction and the novella. I mean, as we've seen with recent Booker Prize shortlists, and as in the Anglo-Saxon world, I think that there's also a lot of genre fiction, sadly too much genre fiction for my liking, in Europe, because they are influenced by American writers in particular. Everyone wants to make money with the writing, and the reader wants easy reads, and that's usually genre fiction. Just for the mere fact that money is becoming sparser in the publishing industry in general, funding is becoming sparser. So you have, as here, increasingly in Europe or on the continent, writers who or can't make a living by writing literary fiction. And literary fiction sells, you know, if a literary fiction book sells 2,000 or even 3,000 copies, as a writer, you can't make a living with that.
It's a continent divided by language, but yet bound together by the history of Enlightenment and Industrial Revolution. Does that make something different to a vast continent like South America, where there's a predominance of people speaking Spanish, or a place like the US, where there's a huge nation only speaking one language? Does that make for a different kind of literary experience?
At best, what's different is the imagery, and that's really what I'm interested in. You know, if you have a writer who is embedded in a certain culture, that it will evoke certain imagery. And so I'll just give you an example. A short novel I became very excited about here is a Icelandic book, which is based on an Icelandic folktale. I don't know that much about Icelandic folktale. And it's just in a nutshell, about a brother and a sister. They're snowed in. He then digs a hole for the sister and gets some help. She is left a girl, going into fantasy world, seeing monsters on the walls, in the snow, and so on. By the time the help returns, she is still alive. But by that point, they think she has turned into a fairy monster. I mean, that immediately got me interested and excited, because it feels to me that is an imagery which could only come from Iceland, or at least a Nordic country. Snow, monsters in the snow. But sadly, I do also feel that there are not enough authors or writers who make use of that. The example, in my view, is often, so you have a lot of Turkish writers and also Arab writers who look, in my view, too much to the West, and try consciously or subconsciously catering for a Western audience, and actually forgetting to use their own imagery and realizing how rich their own imagery, their own heritage is, and that's what they should use in order to express themselves.
With the world coming to the London Book Fair, we welcome two contrasting European novelists to the Books podcast. The Dutch writer Pieter Bouwalda has only just launched his literary career with an explosive debut, Bonita Avenue. But first, we welcome a writer at the peak of her powers. It's almost 20 years since Marie Dariussecq burst onto the scene with Truisme, translated into English as Pigtails, a novel of transformation and lust. It was an instant success and went on to become a Goncourt Prize finalist. 13 novels later, she returns to the theme of change and self-discovery with her disturbing novel of sexual awakening, Clève. As Penny Houston's translation, All the Way, is published in English, Dariussecq came to the studio to explain how she started writing this unsettling story of a young Basque girl going through puberty. Here we catch up with Solange the day after her first kiss, a fumble with a fireman in the local nightclub.
She drops her bike in the grass, steps over the nettles. It's that time in summer, the slack time, deep in summer, when the days to come are as long as those that have gone. Billie Jean is not my love. The river is swollen with green water, bulging as if a swift of water was surging beneath the surface. The soil is on delayed time. It remains there, dusty, shot through with this other matter, this other possible arrangement of matter. Without the slightest ripple, the whole expanse of water spreads over the muddy beaches. The softness of the silence is horrifying. She lies down under the trees. It's the green from primary school, the green you imagine when you think of green. She could stay there forever, tumbling among the trees with her too big body sore from bike riding, sweating, hot, lying down to soothe this stabbing sensation that makes her rush outside, onto the roads, across the countryside. It's impossible to stay inside. Remembering the incredible sequence of gestures and words that led her behind the pillar at Milord's, with the sun shining for no reason, when Rose and whoever are at the beach or lying around the pool, where towns are pulsating with their nightclubs, which are no doubt different from Milord's, when on the disco ball Paris and New York are pulsating and this village is the only dark spot. She dips her fingers in the water, slowly sinking her hands in up to the wrists. The stupidity of this life, that she even needs this stupid body, the bother of it all. She dips her face in her cupped hands. It smells like cold rock and iron. The water runs between her breasts, their ridiculous shape. Her skirt drags and sticks to her thighs, and her pubis is outlined in an upside-down Y. This insistent presence, both empty and full, hungry and glutted, is she the only one to be so obsessed by it? The adult world seems to worry about it a lot, and the whole school always has. But what connection is there between this raging loneliness that makes her stretch her legs restlessly in the cold water and the piss and shit of buttocks and unzipping pants and who faggot fuck prick as if guys' underpants were opened by their mouths?
How did you begin writing this story of a young girl, a young Basque girl, discovering herself?
Obviously, it's partly autobiographical. In general, I write really fiction. It is a fiction. And I write with my imagination. But there I had a raw material with my diary, my teenager diary. I was not too much interested in writing it. I recorded it on tapes, you know, those old big tapes. And I had this box of tapes, like, I don't know, 50 hours of blah, 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 you know, teenager. I never could find time in my life to listen to it. So I decided to take, it took me 3 weeks to listen to it again. And I had to find a Walkman, you know, again, and the right batteries and everything. My kids were looking at it like, you know.
What is this stuff?
What is this? And I was just, it was back in the 80s. Everything went back to me with a sort of, you know, Proustian power because the sounds of the village were on the tapes. There was not only my voice and my Basque accent of that time, but the church bells, the hens in the garden, even the heels of my mother on the tiles, you know, in the house, and the phone ringing, and all these sounds. And I had the novel, not because I was going to tell the story of my teenager, but because I had all this material, you know. The matter of life, the sound of it, really. It was just before HIV, just before, when I started my own sexuality, and just after the so-called sexual liberation. Yes, a real freedom with contraception and the right of abortion, but also still these old stereotypes about boys who have more sexual needs than girls and blah, blah, blah. And can you do it when you have your periods or not, and etc. It was a very specific time because I think, really, sociologically, for the first time in the history of humanhood, I'm sounding very solemn, really, girls, it's not that they had to stay virgin for a wedding, not at all. It was in the 80s, they had to lose their virginity as soon as possible. If you were a virgin at, let's say, 20, you were like an idiot. You were, you know, a dimwit or something. So we were obsessed in the 80s with losing our virginity as soon as possible. And actually, I think this was completely new. For a writer, it's so powerful to have to deal with this very strange situation.
And also, it's a world where they were lost without a map, as it were. These days, you have social media, you'd have internet groups in which you could discuss all this stuff. But Solange, she turns to the dictionary.
Yes, of course, to the dictionary. What is a penis? Because all that she knows about sexual things is the jokes that her macho father tells, you know, in parties, etc. The magazines her mother read, and other stories that other girls say about the first time, you know. But what's funny is that the teenagers of today, when you go on their forums, it's always the same story. It doesn't change so much. What I really wanted to do, and I think almost the entire novel turns around that scene, I wanted to have this scene of a young girl waiting next to a phone. We couldn't go outside with the telephone in the pocket, and we had to stay near this object. It was even before the answering machines. Near the object, not to miss the call, you know, the call.
It's still mediated through words, isn't it? This illusion that you can understand something if you know the word for it. But it was something that you thought worked better on the page.
Yes, I think some things are meant to be read in one's mind, and some things can be read orally, and some pages of this book are better read alone, not because they would be erotically unbearable, but because you have to take time to hear it in your mind, in your own mind.
It's interesting, your fictional village of Clèves brings to mind the Princesse de Clèves, yes, who, of course, famously chooses not to follow her passion, in fact. But it's also a place without romance, without any kind of future.
Well, it's a story of a girl who is deeply and truly interested in sexuality. But in that village, she really lacks information. She's confronted to boys and girls, but boys, because she's heterosexual, that are really clumsy with their bodies and that they really don't know what a girl is. And she doesn't know either what a girl is. She has to find for herself. What she knows about sexuality is also watching the animals copulate. And also, this girl, she has a future. She doesn't know it, but she has a future. And I hope the reader can feel the energy, the vitality she has. Because in a way, she was me. I was her. I mean, and I'm still amazed of what happened to me. I mean, we are able to leave our villages. Yeah, of a girl that has a lot of energy, and the energy is sexual. It's also a sexual energy. She doesn't spend it all with boys. She also thinks, you know, she also dreams.
It's only a few summers later, as you have it, when Solange is, 13 or 15 or so, that she finds herself not only trying to puzzle it out, but actually doing it.
The book was very organized in my mind. The first part is les avoir, having them. It talks about the periods, the adventure of having this blood flowing down your thighs that is so incredibly banal. Every woman has it on the planet, and so incredibly secret, intimate, taboo, and things that everybody knows, but nobody speaks about them. Then the second part of the book is to do it the first time. And the third part of the book is to do it again. Because I think sexuality really begins not with the first time, but with the second and the third, and all these times that you can't count anymore. No, we are not only supposed to lose our virginity as fast as possible, which means too early in general. We were also supposed to do things that were way beyond our real desires. Because everybody speaks about the pornography and the influence of pornography on young people. But at that time, we were already under pressure for what we had to do with our bodies. We didn't receive as many pornographic images, but we did already in magazines and already a bit on TV in France with Canal+. Canal+ is very important in France for the ITs because we were trying to, you know, it was cryptid and we were trying to decrypt it with our own eyes. And
these fuzzy images.
Yeah, the fuzzy images. So it was part of our
something sexual forbidden going on over there.
Yes, but we understood what was happening, of course, and we were supposed to do it. We were supposed to be liberated. We were not supposed to be free. We were supposed to be liberated, especially the women. There was this song in France, Être une femme libérée. But it was a sort of a perversion of women's lib, you know. We were supposed to be liberated, to do sodomy at 14, to, you know, everything. And we actually tried everything. Today we think teenagers are doing too many things or whatever, but it existed in the villages before because we were so bored also. And because we were supposed to do them.
Where was the pressure coming from?
For example, every summer in the magazines my mother read with such an innocence, there were dossiers about frigidity, how not to be frigid. And you had such technical details and the descriptions and even the drawings and the images. It was worse than the Playboys my father read, really. And it gave you an image of the woman like a machine who had to perform, who had to function. And if you didn't have an orgasm like that, you were frigid. All my girlfriends, we were reading that and we tried everything. And my Solange, my character, at some points in the book, I mean, she rapes herself. I cannot really blame the boy. He's stupid, the boy Arnaud. He really takes advantage of her, obviously. But she could say no, and she doesn't. And he would stop if he said no. And the mother and in the next room, etc. She's not exactly in danger. But she does it because she thinks she wants to do it. But she doesn't really want to do it. She's almost a little girl because she lacks information about her own desire, about freedom, about what a girl wants. I don't know. Because there is a man who really loves her in the book. He's so in love with her. He's devastated by that love. And she despises him in a way. So
he's much older than her as well, isn't he?
He's much older. But I think at the end of the book, she's 14 and he must be 24. So, okay, it's bad. And he knows it's bad. He's too old and she's too young. But they are in that grey zone, and I really like those grey zones in, not 50 Shades of Grey, okay, but those real grey zones in literature where you don't have a cop or a teacher or whatever in your room, in your bedroom, in your bed. You are with somebody, you feel desire for him. There is a difference of age. Okay, so what?
He's literally in a position of responsibility. He's abusing that trust right there.
Yes, but she does too, in another way, because she wants to learn things about her body, about male's body, and she's going to use him too, and she's not in love with him, and he's desperately in love with her, and the poor guy, he almost dies of it.
But is that enough? I mean, Solange is so lost, as you say. She doesn't understand what she's doing, what she wants. Is that not his responsibility to look out for that?
You know, there's a narrative logic. I don't know who this guy really is. He's a character in my novel, and he acts according to the logic in the novel. It may appear very cold, but when I write, I never think of what should he do, you know, he's in charge of her, he should protect her. Yes, of course, but the logic of it, she's also a little tiger. She's also, again, she's not a victim. She also wants things from life, and she's going to get them.
Do you ever think about your readers encountering this kind of material? I mean, if they're on the train, on the way into work or whatever, mm-hmm. do you wonder about what they're going to make of it?
I'm conscious that I'm not a writer for leisure. I appeal to the intelligence of the reader. I ask an effort. I really like to tell stories. And so I'm in a very French tradition of literature. I want to give pleasure, but I also want to give it with words and with the beauty of the language. I hope when you read my books, you want to read them again at some point in your life, like 20 years later, perhaps, because it will give you something else. And yes, that's my ambition.
I mean, I'm wondering if this, in some sense, is a revisiting of some of the themes you explored with Truisme all those years ago, but from a different perspective.
Of course it is, yes. It's a much more realistic Pigtails, Truisme. Pigtails, Truisme was also, in a way, the story of a puberty, because it's the story of a woman turning into a monster, into a sow, because perhaps of the way men look at her, but not only that. So she turns into a monster because all of us, boys and girls, we turn into freaks and monsters when we were teenagers. We were looking at our hair and those things that were coming out of us like monsters. And we all lived that.
All the Way, translated by Penny Houston, is published by Text. Peter Buwalder is a writer who's only just setting out on his literary adventure. His first novel, Bonita Avenue, is a best-selling blockbuster, which won a raft of awards in the Netherlands and has gone on to be translated into 11 languages, reaching English earlier this week. It's a family saga for the internet age, the father, a former judo champion and mathematician and rector of Trubantio University, his daughter and her boyfriend, hooking up to make a killing from their internet porn site. It's an age in which, for the first time in history, says Buwalder, younger generations are wiser than their elders.
We have, for the first time in history, the situation. The elder generation isn't the most knowing, the most experienced. You can have a grandfather with a small son on his chest, and the son knows more about sex than his grandfather. Seen a lot of more girls on the internet and so on. So the clash is between generations.
Where did it start? Was it with that insight?
Yes. back in 2005, when I got the idea, we were standing in a train and I saw a billboard with only an internet address on it. And that starts me thinking about real world and virtual world and what has it changed. And I was thinking about all those porn sites everybody has seen already, but no one was talking about.
The intersection between the virtual and the real, and the way that this would explode a kind of family.
Yes, the content that has to be made, because the internet made everything that was in print already, Playboy, Penthouse, explode. A lot of more content to be seen. The market was growing bigger for it. So I was thinking there are also girls making those pictures in an environment that is safe and good and with friends and people and parents who are into it. So there are, every picture has its own family tragedy in it. So I start inventing a family wherein a girl was living with this secret.
Is it a particular kind of family that this would have to come from? It's a family of lies, the one you've constructed.
Yeah, I think everybody has something to hide in life. So
particularly maybe a man who is as successful as seems Sigirius.
Yes, of course. But he is the one with the cleanest sheet. He's a guy who isn't that sexual, who is always ambitious, who is trying to make the best of his life. So it was painful and interesting to give him offspring who isn't like that, who chooses the easiest way to get their money, to get fame, to get fortune, etc. So he is always trying, he's ambitious, and children aren't.
Was it obvious to you straight away that you had to tell it in pieces, and also with a double time scale?
Yes, the reason for me to have a different perspective was because of the moral viewpoint. The daughter, then I had to be like her, seeing no problem in it. When I choose Sigirius, then he would be condemning it. So when I spread it over a few people, there's no moral viewpoint in the novel. So when you read it, you can choose it yourself.
So the reader has to fill in that gap for themselves.
It's much more interesting to have different views, knowledge that the other one hasn't. You can give the reader knowledge that the next person who is telling hasn't. So for tension and for a plot, it's very helpful.
Sigirius, when you introduce him as a mathematician, is someone you say who knows his onions about coincidence, who, having taught courses in probability theory and stochastic optimization.
When a coincidence plays a large role in life, there's no problem, because in real life, coincidences happen. But in fiction, you have to make sure that it's not annoying. So my trick was to give Sigirius more knowledge about chance than the reader. So I make him a maths professor, and he can think about it on a higher level than the reader. So then coincidence is a strength.
Because you need a certain amount of coincidence for this kind of plot to function.
Yeah, because I make him asexual. He's a man who is not into sex, who is indifferent to his marriage, his wife.
Children have always hidden from their parents. You only have to look at Sigirius hiding his own interest in judo from his father, who was imprisoned by the Japanese. But, I mean, is this the subject for your novel? Comes from this tension about the way that the internet makes the stakes much, much higher, makes the possibilities much more dangerous?
Yes, morals are changing very fast since the internet is there. But also, he is into internet. He is governing one of the fastest internet networks in Holland, namely that of the University of Twente. So he is involved also.
And the novel is kind of forged from this realization that in fact everything that happens in the virtual world comes from or is connected to the real
world. Yeah, that's true. When she starts this website, she's still pioneering, and she knows that. The girl, Joni, she's very clever. She studies business and economics, and she feels that there is a gap and there is a chance for getting rich in a short time. We're talking about 1996, 1997, when the internet was booming. But another line in the novel is 2008, and I depict the state of pornography on the internet in that year. And it's like starting out with Gutenberg and the book press and ending with an iPad. Mm. Yeah, the explosion between those years, 1997 and 2008, is immense. So it was my task while writing to depict both, because when I only showed how it was in 1997, it wasn't complete. So that's, for instance, a reason that I give her an afterlife after the Enschede period, an afterlife in Los Angeles.
Did you worry that by writing this novel with its subject, that you were contributing to that explosion, normalizing something that was so very anormal before?
Oh, no. No, I wasn't afraid, because literature is slow. it's like a Trojan horse, and nobody's waiting for it. So the people who are reading it, they figured out their ways on the internet already. It's more reflecting, and no, I wasn't afraid of that. I had to work twice as hard to make it believable, to make it interesting, because porn isn't interesting. That's the paradox in it. It's nice maybe, but it isn't interesting. So to make it interesting and work into a piece of literature, I had to work harder. So I have to choose an environment, I think, was my thought for Joni, that was complicated and non-banal. So it isn't the core of the story, I think. I started out with the porn, but the core of the story is more like family values and ambition.
Do you feel, as part of a kind of Dutch literary scene, do you feel a kind of Dutch writer, or are you more international than that?
My influences, my favorite novels, aren't Dutch novels all the time. Of course, there are some real good Dutch novelists and books, but my peers or writers I've learned something from, they're more American or English.
Bonita Avenue, translated by Jonathan Reeder, is published by Pushkin Press. This week, Guardian Weekly investigates the secrets and rules of French dining etiquette, while next week's book podcast finds Emma Donoghue at the Guardian Book Club, where she discusses her Booker shortlisted novel, Room. To find it and a host of other books audio, just search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can listen online, follow us on SoundCloud, or subscribe via iTunes. Until then, from me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Tim Mabey, thanks for tuning in.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.